Slackers Podcast. Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers. I hope you are all good. I hope your podcast needs are being met at the moment and that the first tan of spring is coming onto your skin. I mean, I'm as white as a ghost. I went to Croatia for a couple of weeks last year and didn't tan at all. Didn't even burn. The sun sees me as like a major insignificance and just manages to beam itself around me. Yeah, well, if you're like brand new to the Slacker Podcast, I don't talk about my suntan for an hour. As interesting as that would be, and do you know what? I've heard worse podcasts out there. This is a podcast where we get the amazing people in music from all around the world to sit down and chat to me for an hour. And we get their early demos on. Normally, we get something from like back when they were a little bit rubbish, before they were the incredible artists, the seminal album making person that is before you now. It's good to get back to that stage, and especially if you've made music at some point or are making music, you know what it's like when you're starting out in a project, and you can learn a lot about where an artist comes from those demos as well. Also, sometimes when you play them their early tracks, they like to, you can see them sort of close their eyes and kind of almost morph themselves back to the future style into that like shitty little rehearsal room or that awful little studio that they paid like £20 in. So it's always a pleasure and a privilege to chat to great musicians. So just before we get started, I want to tell you a little bit about this book that I've written. It's called The Slacker's Guide to the Music Industry. If you've been listening the whole way through the series, you'll have heard me whanging on about it over and over and over again. But guess what? It comes out in 2 weeks. It comes out on May the 16th, and I'm super excited. This week, as I record this, it's a Tuesday when I'm recording this, I will be at Music Cork, which is an industry event which is happening in the south of Ireland, on Wednesday and Thursday. And then the good people at Live at Leeds and the Unconference at Live at Leeds have asked me to take the book up there and do a keynote, which will be the first ever keynote that I've done. I'm going to have to stand up in front of a couple of hundred people and not shit myself, basically. I think that's the plan for that. But I will be taking books with me to the Cork event and the Leeds event. And of course, I will be at the Great Escape. I've moved to Brighton. How could I not go to the Great Escape? I will be doing a Help Musicians panel on the Thursday, one on the Friday, one on the Saturday. And I'll be selling books down there as well. If you are interested in making music or the industry at all, it's not boring. It's not one of these like, and this is what you do then, and this is what you do then. I did loads of interviews with really interesting artists like Wolf Alice and Run the Jewels and Frank Turner. And yeah, this goes on and on and on. So even if you don't make music and you know someone who does, buy it for them as a present. Easy. www.philtigerslacker.com. And I have just put my first range of t-shirts. I sound like Versace, Donatella Versace up here. Yes, my first range of t-shirts have gone online. But yeah, we've got the book up there. We've got an e-book up there. We've got t-shirt up there. I mean, if I keep going the way I'm going, in about a year's time, I'll have started my own Amazon. Take that, Jeff Bezos. How about that? And it's all right, guys. I'll cut yous all in the shares. Right, enough rambling from me. This week's podcast is with the one and only Glenn Hansard. You may know him from being Glenn Hansard. You may know him from the lead singer of The Frames, the writer from The Frames. You may know him from the movie Once. You may know him from The Commitments. Or you may know him from busking around Dublin in his early days. He still does it. He was so ridiculously interesting. Like we could have talked for hours and hours and hours, and there's bits and pieces that we've had to clip out. We get very honest in it. I really enjoyed doing this podcast, and Glenn Hansard's brilliant, and he's got an album that just came out a couple of weeks ago as well. So it was great to sit down and chat to Glenn Hansard for the Slacker Podcast. Here it is, in three, in two, in one. Glenn Hansard, hello.
How are you?
Not too bad. How's things going today? What are you up to?
Really good. I just got into London last night. I've been on a bit of a sort of a press trip around Europe, and funnily, I left my guitar at home by accident. I just completely forgot it when I left the house, and so it's been an interesting, adventurous few days of me picking up guitars from friends and borrowing. In Paris, I met a street musician, and at 11 o'clock in the morning, he was out singing Charles Aznavour's La Bohème. And I went to him and I said, listen, I'm a street musician also. Is there any chance I could, I have this radio session and I left without my guitar. Is there any chance I could borrow your guitar for the afternoon? And he looked at me and he said, okay. And he handed me the guitar, and it was so. I just thought
he didn't want money for it.
I volunteered. Of course, I volunteered money. I gave him 50 quid, and I thought, you know, after he had given me the instrument, I gave him 50 quid and said, "That's for your time." And he said, "Well, thank you very much." He said, "I'll be here in this bar this evening," because, you know, he liked the bar.
Yeah.
And he said, "Maybe come back if you can around 7:30. And I went back later on, and I'd already broke a string on his guitar. So I put some more money in the box for strings. But a very generous man. And I thought, you know, it's good to know that we still live in a world where
that's crazy. You
can just speak to people and they'll get it.
That sounds like something that would have happened in like the 70s, 60s or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. 2019 feels like more of a time when everybody's kind of looking out for themselves in this big bad world. You know what?
You're absolutely right. The sort of level of compassion and empathy have kind of plummeted. But I have to say that, and if living well is, you know, if living by example is the way to go, this was a moment that I really, really admired. And I have to say that guy embodied all of the things that I love about musicians and about the world that we live in.
That's incredible. Like, if somebody had come up to you a couple of years ago when you were out busking and asked for your guitar, what would you have told them?
I have to say, it would be a complicated question. I would really.
It's a moral dilemma, isn't
it? Yeah, because your guitar is your tool. It's also one of your best friends. It's the thing you enter. You enter that strange place with the, you know, you when you dip into the dark, when you go behind the hedges of your own, you know, creativity. That's the instrument that goes with you. So it's a very personal thing.
My friend has I played in bands with him since we were no age, and he's still playing the same acoustic guitar that he was playing when he was 14. Mm. I think his parents like shelled out and got him a Takamine.
Nice.
And it's got about 4 holes in it now, and it just looks like it's ready for the dump.
Yeah.
Do you know?
I know exactly.
But you've got a guitar called the Horse, is it?
I have a Horse, and it's called the Horse just because it's a workhorse. And it's similar to your friends. It's got all these holes, and I think it has something to do with what Takamine did with the wood. There was a certain model, the natural model, and the wood is not treated, so plectrums just eat into that wood really quickly. And I've seen a load of them, and I'd love to make a collection of photographs of all the Takamines that I know of, friends who work in bars and who just kind of work in musicians, you know, because those guitars are they're incredible, and they begin to look really old very quick.
They're fairly robust.
They are. They're a great workhorse.
I'm going to play a track now at the start of every Slacker podcast for anybody who's just tuning in, specifically for you and hasn't listened to this before. We open up with an early demo. As early as I could find, I found a session that you did for Dave Fanning on RTE.
Yeah.
And the track was called Martha, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. But then I just sort of got into this, again, another moral quandary, maybe a legal quandary. I was like, I don't want RTE to sue me, so
I decided they won't know.
I work for the BBC as well. It would be like, it'd be a double scalp for them. So I've decided to play a track from the First Frames album, which I think came out in 1990, was it?
91, I think.
91.
Yeah.
And the track is called The Dancer.
Bars.
After listening to that, what's the first thing that goes through your head?
Well, I was thinking about that boy who wrote that song, and I'm listening to it there, and I'm thinking about all of those influences, that mash of, you know, maybe 9 months before I made that record, I remember being on acid with my best friend, and we had gone into HMV on Grafton Street at like 9 a.m. because we'd been up all night walking the streets. And I bought the Pixies' Surferosa on tape. And we had both had our Walkmans with us, and we decided it would be an amazing idea if we both bought a tape and went up onto the top of a car park and just sat above Dublin and listened to the tape.
Yeah.
So he bought the Wonder Stuff Hup, which had just come out at the time, and I bought the Pixie Surferosa. I bought it for the cover. I didn't even know anything about the band.
that's good luck, that one.
Yeah, and I remember going. Yeah, it was. It was a great, great fortunate moment. And I went up on the roof, and I just heard. You're the bone machine. And I was like, maybe it was the drugs, but I was just like, wow, this had blown me right open. But right previous to that, in a kind of a funny sort of a way, it affected my first album in quite a negative way, I feel now.
Yeah.
Without any judgment on that, but I had kind of discovered this wild energy of this band.
But that's the thing. It's weird you use the word energy, because that's the first thing that came into my head when I heard it. I was just like, the rhythm of the guitar is just pure energy, and you're kind of yipping and yelping.
Yeah, you know? And so to sort of conclude what I was just saying, actually, it's for, what I hear in that is I hear all that Waterboys influence, I hear all that busking influence, you know, the guitar going, you know, because when you're busking, you're constantly just lambing into the guitar, you know. And what I also hear, and I'm listening to the accent I'm singing in, which is really strange for me, because it's sort of a strange kind of accent. I'm sort of, you can hear this weird, she was in a class, and I know where that's coming from now, and it's hit me for the first time that I just had gotten into REM.
Yeah, yeah.
And Stipe had that kind of strong southern Georgian accent in his singing, and I'm just listening to it now, and it's so naked for me to, I can deconstruct it so easily just listening to it there, but at the time I felt like I was, you know, expressing my own voice and this was my own song, but actually it's a wonderful melge of everything that was happening in my life at the time. And also the dancer was my girlfriend at the time, Siobhan Wilmot, who was an amazing dancer, and we met, I was like 18 and she was 17, and I remember it was such a powerful moment in my life.
It was like proper furtive love, isn't it?
Amazing. I was busking, and I remember she was standing in the crowd watching us busk, and I was like, wow, I felt head over heels. And afterwards we...
Did she give you a punt?
She didn't. No, because she didn't have one. But afterwards we sat in a cafe and she was there. And I remember she kind of slapped me on the shoulder as she was leaving. And she said, is that your Vespa? Because I had a Vespa outside with the Pixies written on it. And I said, yeah. She said, bring me for a ride. And she gave me an earring. She says, here's an earring, I'll pay for the ride. And so I brought her out to the sea, and we sat there on the rocks and we kissed. It was very romantic.
I don't even think Bruce Springsteen could cook up a narrative like that. It seems so perfect.
It's a very specific memory, that song.
No, I loved listening to that. Like, when was the last time you actually heard that track or anything from the first Frames album?
Do you know, I haven't listened to it in a long, long time. I did hear a snippet of it about 6 months ago when my young neighbour came up to the house and he found a Frame single, and he didn't know how to work the record player, so I showed him how to put it on, and we played the 45, the original Island Records print, yeah. 45, and it was at the record played at 33, and I remember thinking, Jesus, that band sounds good. And it was like,
it's the heavy metal version.
Yeah, well, it sounded like my Billy Valentine or something. I was like, God, yeah, we should have released it at that speed.
What was it like sort of growing up, what was the first sort of like music that you were sort of, that was in your sort of house, really?
Well, I mean, it's a very easy answer. The music that was in my house was, of course, you know, traditional Irish music and the Dubliners, and, you know, my mother, of course, loved them. She loved the Beatles, and she loved Dylan, and she loved Cohen. When I was 5 years old, I'll never forget it, my mother taught me Bird on a Wire, and I remember sitting on the side of the sink, and she was bathing us, me and my brother, in the sink in the kitchen, and she had one of those little record player, suitcase record players, and she taught my brother The Sound of Silence, and she taught me Bird on a Wire. So, and for me, what attracted me to that song was the lyric, like a drunk in a midnight choir.
Yeah,
I always loved that lyric, even though I didn't quite grasp what it meant. And so it was, but it was mostly, you know, my dad was one of these guys that He loved to drink and he worked hard and he loved to go out. But he would come home some nights very late with friends.
Of course.
And the hoolie was back in our house. So the house would be full of people. And of course, those people would end up spending the night. And sometimes they'd end up spending a few nights. And occasionally they'd end up spending a few weeks in our house. And so we grew up listening to Rebel songs and, you know, songs about the North and songs about England and songs about Ireland. And, you know, people having to leave to go to Van Diemen's Land and prison, all this stuff. And so I kind of grew up around this wealth of passion and frustration about England and about, you know,
I mean, you're a product of your environment. I mean, you've got lots of people like that.
100%.
Like singing those songs. Like I almost feel jealous sometimes because when I just moved from London, but we used to go to the traditional sessions every single Friday in Stoke Newington. And my friend Blondie knew all the traditional Irish tracks. Like, you know, the ones with 16 verses.
I know.
And he'd stand up. He'd be about seven pints of stout in him. And he'd stand up with arms behind the back.
Yeah.
And he'd just be going at it. And I'm like waiting for the chorus going, go on, go on.
There's great romance in it.
Yeah.
It's the kind of romance you can get pulled deep into and you can get pulled way too far into it. And, you know, these guys that used to hang around our house, we refer to them as our drunkles because they weren't family and they were definitely more familiar than strangers.
Yeah.
And so it is, you know, you're right. There is wonderful romance in this Irish notion of, you know, 10 pints and a long dirge.
As we record this on a Friday, I'm starting to plan my night out in my head now. Like with that and with people coming into your house at a young age and singing those songs and, you know, you being brought up at this like moment where your head's a sponge and you're taking so much in. Was it art and literature with that as well, or was it mainly music? Were people getting up and reciting poems? Was there books in your house?
There were poems, there were books, but the books were all by Catherine Cookson. I mean, I didn't grow up in a literate home. I mean, my mother loved to read, but it wasn't, they didn't go deep in that way.
Yeah.
Real working class family. My dad liked detective novels. You know, there was never really a big sort of literary thing in my house. And actually it was only when I started to really see a lot of my headmaster when I was quite young, because my headmaster, I was constantly getting sent to him because I was one of these students who recently met a teacher of mine who taught me maths. And she said, I said to her, and I met her at a funeral a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And she said, tell me honestly, what was I like as a student? Because I actually don't remember.
Yeah.
She said, Glenn, you were horrible. You were awful. And I was like, really? Is that truth? She said, yeah, you were kind of lovable because you could see it wasn't coming from a bad place, but you were awful in school. I didn't like you. And I thought, wow, that's very, very honest. And it was only through those people. I mean, my headmaster was a very good man, and he introduced me to books, introduced me to kind of, you know, I had never really read for pleasure. I'd only read for school. And he gave me some pointers, and he was the guy that actually let me out of school when I was 13. He said, look, you leave school, do me a favor, start, you want to do music, I know, it's clear. Start at the bottom, start on the street, and if in 6 months it doesn't work out, come back and I'll get you back into school.
It sounds like you were acting up because the headmaster was your best friend and the only way to get to see him was just by, you know, by throwing paper or acting the wag, do you know? Mm. Yeah, because like I did see that. Now, all I could think of it is like, that would have been 1983.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, that's illegal.
It was actually at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying,
you can't leave school till 15 or 16, can you?
No, you can't leave school till 15 officially. But, you know, having said that, you know, I grew up in Ballymun, a great place to grow up. I have no problem with it at all. I loved it. But my school, in my class, there was like, you know, 38 to 40 students at any one time.
And that's a lot for a classroom.
It's a lot of people in a class. And also the teachers were really working hard. And there was a kind of, it was once said, and I could probably get into trouble for saying this, but there was a kind of an attitude of like, let's get these kids ready for work. I remember conversations about, look, we're not expecting you to get as far as you're leaving. We would love you to get as far as your intercert, you know, get a trade. You know, there was a lot of talk in our school about trade, get yourself a trade. And I guess, you know, Ireland was a third world country at that time. And, you know, we were trying to get people to a point where they could go out and earn a living.
You see a lot of that when you watch documentaries about music in the late 70s, early 80s in Manchester.
Exactly.
Like I watch the old sort of punk documentaries, you'll hear people talking about how they went to school and it was almost like they were being farm fed into the factories.
100%.
Like almost like a conveyor belt from primary school, secondary school, factory, life, coffin. Do you know?
100%. And I remember teachers coming in and giving the students lectures about, you know, you got to get out there and you got to earn, you got to take care of your parents, you know, you'll get married young, you know, all of this stuff.
There was no notions of creativity or being an artist or an actor or, you know, like throwing your hand at something that, you know, people would have thought you were mad.
Absolutely. And I haven't said that. I've met many people from my school years later and lots of people doing very well for themselves. So it's not, it wasn't that we were being, you know, but you know, there was something about Pink Floyd's The Wall film that did seem to resonate with where we were at the time.
The Wall.
Yeah, The Wall, yeah.
You grew up in Ballymun and like being from, like, I'm from Oma. So like everything that's force fed me about from down south is from the media.
Yeah.
And the media give Ballymun a really hard touch about being somewhere where crime is very bad or drugs are very bad. And I don't really get the idea that that's actually, maybe it's not the case, but like they paint a sort of false picture of it.
Well, Ballymun was the lowest on the list for most people who were looking for a home, because Ballymun was Ireland's first high-rise flats, first tower blocks.
Right by the airport in Dublin,
right
isn't
by the airport. Yeah. It was quite far out. There was no great facilities. There was no real shopping centre. There was, you know, There was only two bars that served many, like, you know, I'm talking about tens of thousands
of people. You don't want to get barred from there, do you?
Exactly. it was kind of a rough place in that people would, a lot of my memory of being young was that a lot of my friends, I only had a lot of my friends for 1 year, for maybe 2 years. Mm-hmm. A lot of my friends came to Ballymun, they lived there for a bit and then they got on the housing list and they got a place in Crumlin or they got a place in Finglas.
Sure.
So Ballymun was really a place, a transient sort of, it was almost like a big train station. Mm-hmm. People would come and live there for a very short time. A lot of people from the north. I mean, one of my best friends when I was a kid was Brendan McGee. I'd love to. It would be amazing.
That's my cousin's name.
Is that your cousin's name? It would be amazing if you heard.
There's a couple of Brendan McGees in Ireland. Like.
Does he have a brother called Sean?
No, I don't think
okay,
so.
Okay, because Brendan, you know, and there was a lot of people would come down from Longkesh.
Yeah.
So a lot of northern families would move into Ballymun. And they'd be there for maybe a year or two and you'd see all of the artwork on the wall with the silver thread and the nails, you know, and you'd see the Saoirse and you'd see that, you know, you'd know exactly who these people were. You know?
The Northern Irish ones always sort of try harder, don't they?
Well,
when it comes to being a bit of a rebel, like,
well, that sense,
they'll paint it everywhere.
Exactly.
So overcompensating.
That sense of identity.
We're Irish too, you know.
Exactly. We're more Irish than you. We're suffering. But it's true, actually. I mean, there was a huge number of Northern Irish people in Ballymun.
So when you left school, you were 13 and you were busking away from, what, 13 to 20 before you started the band?
Probably about 18.
18,
yeah.
Right. Mm. What sort of songs were you playing out in the street? Like, and were you out there like treating it like a job? Was it like 9 to 5?
No. I mean, I did it every day, but I didn't treat it as a job at all. And I realised pretty quickly, I mean, my repertoire was all Dylan. I mean, that was all I had. You know, Dylan. I was just singing Dylan. And then
you have to be pretty good to play Dylan, though, like with the chords and stuff that he has.
Absolutely. And I was, because I was really a student of his. I also played the deeper songs of his, and so in a way I didn't make as much money. And I remember someone came along one day and they played a Van the Man song and I was like, Jesus man, you can make some money playing Van. Van had that thing, like, you know, his songs are really, they're inclusive and you can belt them out, and whereas I was playing sort of deeper, you know, It's Alright Ma, Money Bleeding, or, you know, I was going into the Gates of Eden, and, you know,
you're playing the lesser known Bob Dylan.
I was, because they were the songs I loved. It wasn't because I was trying to be oblique. Mm-hmm. But then when Van, and then Neil Young, and then I discovered, and then the Waterboys released This Is the Sea, and that was a real game changer for me and a lot of my friends. It's the first time I remember ever sitting down and learning a whole album, like with
from
the
start to finish.
Yeah, we learned the whole thing.
I did the same thing at university. I wasn't going out. I wasn't drinking with everybody in first year. I had a girlfriend at that stage back home and I just decided I wasn't going to go out, and I was sitting in and I was just like, I learned the whole of the Stone Roses 2 albums on bass from start to finish.
Nice. What a great exercise.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. And then a friend of mine introduced me to a band, R.E.M., and it was like, who are these guys? Oh, they're American. They're from Georgia. Amazing band. And then, of course, that was a whole new element that came into the music, and then of course later on was bands like the Pixies and stuff. And but at the basis of all of that was the Dubliners, Whereas the Clancy Brothers, mm-hmm. you know, the Bothy Band and Planxty and all of these bands that just, they're the wellspring of everything that came later.
There was a statue unveiled of Luke Kelly very recently from the date that we recorded this now. Mm-hmm. And you played at the unveiling of it. I think Damien Dempsey played as
myself
well.
And Damien,
what was that like?
And John Sheehan. It was a really, it was an incredible moment for me. It was one of those life moments where I looked around me and I thought, wow, because this guy is, you know, he is the great bard. And it's really wonderful that Ireland is finally giving him the recognition that he very much deserves. He was a great socialist. He was a great thinker. The Dubliners, of course, had a lot of weight. But the Dubliners, you know, went into the world and they, you know, they'd never really cracked America. And so they were kind of always considered more of a home band, even though they did amazingly well in Europe. It was a real honor for me to sing, and I was singing to Luke's family and his sister, and actually his sister who I knew years ago anyway from a different moment in my life. But just this incredible thing to be playing for his family and to be playing, you know, the President Higgins was there, and
I saw him. He was like slapping his knee along to it. He was absolutely loving it.
Man, I'm so happy he's our president. He's just the right.
You look around the world and you look at the other presidents and this, that, and the other. And how blessed are you to have Miggledy?
I love him.
Miggledy Higgins.
I love him. Absolutely love him. And you know, his parents fought on both sides of the Irish Civil War. And we're just coming into a very difficult time for the Irish in terms of reflecting back on, you know, because you had 1916 and you had all of what that was about and what it meant and, you know, the blood sacrifice and all the rest. But the Civil War is a horrible part of our history. It's a sad and deep and strange, and we haven't never investigated it.
Yeah, yeah.
We've never spoken about it. It's all there to be discovered. And Michael D, both his parents were fighting on both sides of that. So I think he's the right president.
At this time.
If there is dialogue to be had, that he's the right man to sit at the centre of it.
There's always been a dark underbelly to stuff that goes on in Ireland with the Magdalen Laundries. And even with the situation with immigration in Ireland at the minute, it's a very, very dark moment.
It's horrendous.
Moment.
It's horrendous. You know, also the kind of ideological fixation by our government, you know, the Fine Gael, the way they're dealing with families being thrown out of their homes is really shocking to see a government sort of take the attitude that this is just collateral damage, you know, for an economy that's doing well. They're all about the figures. They're not interested in the lives. And so and of course these people are doing their best. I'm not here just throwing stones for no reason. People do their best. But there's an ideological problem, and it's very, very difficult to see it and to witness it, and to see the lack of empathy and the lack of compassion from the highest offices in the land. And that's why, again, I'm grateful for Michael D. Higgins. At least he's in office, and he's a strong character, and he's a man who actually thinks, and he's got a heart. And I'm not saying that the others don't, but there's a huge
there's something not right in
there's
there.
There's a void. Yeah.
So 1990, what is the state of Irish music like around that stage?
It's a very good question, because I actually don't know. I joined a band without having any contact with Irish music other than the Irish music of my childhood.
Yeah.
So I appeared into a kind of...
You weren't palling about with Bono. You weren't running about with Sinead O'Connor.
No, those guys were all kind of heroic, and they had gone off in the world and made their way, but it wasn't their records I grew up with. And so I guess when my band, The Frames, came into our own, our peers would have been, like Hottest Flowers would have been sort of bit before us. Our peers would have been people like An Emotional Fish, The Pale, which were a great band, kind of almost like klezmer rock, Engine Alley, which were a powerful band from Kilkenny, you know. And then you had people, you know, gosh. Anyway, it was a very broad scene. It was a very interesting time. I didn't know anything. Our House. I didn't really know anything. My Bloody Valentine had gone to London and made Loveless. But I didn't really know much about what was going on. And I never really cared. It wasn't really something I was that worried about. What really was interesting to me was getting to America. I never even had that thing, to be honest, of getting to London. Even though I signed with Chris Blackwell at Island Records, I never had that wish to get to London or to break England, you know. I was just like, let's get to the States where we can, you know. I guess I wanted
that's
to be,
in your DNA though, isn't
well,
it?
Only because my favorite artist, even though I thought they were from America, it turns out most of them were from Canada, but but the artists that I gravitated towards were from that part of the
yeah.
world.
So how did you go about getting the frames together? Was it like friends? Was it how'd it go?
It was, I made a demo tape of some songs in 1988, and Marina Guinness, who part of the Guinness family, was a friend who used to come and support me when I was busking, give me a few quid. She invited me to her house where I met Van Morrison and I met Ronnie Wood and Marianne Faithfull.
And was this some sort of like Guinness party?
It was just an afternoon. She said, "Come out, I've got some friends at the house, and I'd really like them to hear your music." And it was great. Stuart Copeland, sorry, I forgot him there. He was there also, and I remember there was a kind of a, you know, very generous thing to do, to take a young busker to put their cassette in.
That
the
it really is. Like, I don't think I've heard much of that before.
Well, that's very much Marina's character. She's a wonderful, wonderful person, and the Guinness family historically have always been very supportive of the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sat down in the house, and she lives in the countryside, and we listened to the tape, and I remember Marianne Faithfull saying we should call Chris and we should let you know, and I spoke to Chris Blackwell on the phone that evening, and he heard my tape, and a week later he said, "You want to come to London? I'll have a chat." And I came to London and met with Chris, and I basically, that was the beginning of me signing. I signed my first record contract, and I was given some money.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was given £15,000 at the time, which was a huge amount
of
money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
Yeah, and I went to some busker friends and I said, "Do you want to play bass in my band, or do you want to play drums, or do you want to play guitar?" And I put the frames together out of people that I met within a sort of a week or so, but people that I'd known.
Yeah,
and
they're buskers as well, which means they're going to be sort of robust on tour. You know, they're going to know their shit.
Exactly, and so that band lasted, that lineup lasted about 3 years, and then of course people began to, you know, John Carney, who made Once many many years later. He left the band to pursue, you know, he wanted to make films. Dave Odlin left the band to record. And it's funny, I still have contact with all these people and they're still in my day-to-day life, but they left the frames pretty early on.
It sounds like it wasn't like one of those, like, you know, like all those heavy metal bands, once you're out of the band, that guy's a fucking asshole. Fuck that guy. It all seems fairly pleasant.
Well, we were mates, you know, so there was no... And, you know, if... For instance, when John decided he wanted to leave and make films, of course you're not going to. I mean, I was pissed because I didn't have a bass player in my band, but I was also really happy for him. I mean, you have to be.
Had somebody to do the music videos as well.
Right, exactly.
So what was the ambition when the frame sort of like started out? And why did you not call yourself Glenn Hansard and just have the rest of the guys as session musicians, seeing as it was you that got signed at the start?
You know what, you're right there. And it may have saved a little time, and it would have made things more honest or whatever, because I was signed.
There's a romance of being in a band as well though, isn't
it? Well, that's what I wanted. And I was a big fan of like the Waterboys and the Pixies, and I wanted to be in a band. But now looking back on it, it really was a singer and his friends. I mean, don't get me wrong, the frames contributed so much and more through the years. I mean, by the time we got to For the Birds, I was definitely a member of, you know, a member of a band, as opposed to a guy coming in with songs. And the band very much shaped that sound. But yeah, it was on paper Glenn Hansard and the Frames.
Yeah.
But as time went on, I just became more honest with that. And now I'm at a point where it's like, what's wonderful about just making records under my own name is that I can play music with whoever I want, and I can hire people. And
there's
no question of like, so what about this idea? It's just like, well, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, the Frames lads used to call me Customs. You know, it's like everything has to get through Customs. You know? Any ideas?
But I think like, and I've learned this, and some of my friends have learned this from being in groups and collectives and the like, that sometimes if there's a strong leader in the group, then sometimes it's better just to like sort of let them do their thing, and if you've got your project, you go do your thing.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, yeah, I couldn't imagine you playing with, say, on Colin McInerney's like latest album. Yeah. He'd be like going, "Fuck off, Glenn, this is mine."
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
Was the ambition for the band to be the biggest band in the world? Were you one of those bands? Because like, you
Not
know, 9 out of 10 bands will start and they'll be like, "We're going to be bigger than Jesus."
You know, it's funny. Yeah, I can honestly respond to that by saying I never felt like being the biggest band in the world or anything remotely like it was in on my radar. I did like the idea of being kind of part of the firmament of music. I liked the idea of being going out there and making music and being one of the bands that on the road. And I always liked the idea. I always liked the company of other bands, and I always liked the conversation about music. But being the biggest, fast and the loudest was not really... You see, U2 threw such a big shadow in a funny kind of a way. And then also Bob Dylan is another... He's just on a different level to most anyone I've ever heard, that in a way there was no question of trying to better those guys.
Yeah, just do your thing.
Just do your thing. And, yeah. You know, the giants, the mountains of music already existed.
You released that album in 1991, mm-hmm. The track that we heard off earlier. And then The Commitments came around.
Yeah.
So pretty much straight away. And the first thing that, if you haven't seen The Commitments, number one, what are you doing with your life? Why have you not seen that? My mom's partner, my stepdad, got four copies of it one Christmas three copies on DVD one wow. Christmas by three of us.
That's amazing.
Because we were just like, it must have been a reissue or something like that.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, he loved that. And then we all sat down and watched it, and we had two extra ones that we had to give out. It's one of those things that it has been in every Irish household, and it's been and beyond and the rest.
It's a powerful, a powerful memory.
But you were releasing music around about the same time, so people must have got you confused, because more people would have seen you in The Commitments than would have heard your demo album, or sorry, your debut
first
album.
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
must have been a real head fuck.
It was. And I remember coming to England and doing interviews, and everyone would call me Outspan. And I remember just sort of being like wow, that's not who I am. That's not what I do. I'm a musician. And, you know, my experience in The Commitments was such an amazing, you know, the friendships I made with the rest of the cast and stuff was just really an incredible thing. And also to learn that music, that was a huge part of my education, was to really get my head around those songs because they're such deep songs and such great songs. I have a kind of a strange memory, one memory that's kind of the fly in the ointment, if you like. And that was, I remember Alan Parker at the beginning of the shooting said, if you need to take some time off, we need 2 weeks' notice because it's a big, you know, there's a lot of people involved.
In yeah.
there. And I had a concert, one of my first concerts, I think probably was my second gig with the Frames, I remember now.
Yeah.
And it was in the Purty Loft, which was in Dublin. It was just on the outskirts of Dublin. And I remember saying, is it possible? And I had to give a written explanation.
Get your mum to sign it.
Exactly, kind of thing. And I did, you know, and I asked, could I have one night off? I remember it was the 15th of September. And they gave me the night off. I went and I played my gig. All the cast and crew came to the concert, which was great. And it was a really good gig for the band. And I was so happy. And afterwards, I remember when the filming stopped, I remember Alan Parker pulling me aside in a corridor of his hotel. He said, come here, I want to say something. And he said, you know, on every film I make, there's one cunt. I didn't think it would be you. I remember thinking,
what?
Why? And he used that word. And I was like, why would this man say this to me? I did nothing wrong.
Uh-huh.
You know, I did exactly what I was asked. I had a great time doing it. And to be honest with you, that kind of spoiled it for me. I couldn't really go forward with a feeling that this guy had been, you know, because, you know, we all want to.
Is that just because you took the cast down for one night?
He never explained to me what it was, but I assume it was that.
Wow.
Yeah. And so in a way.
That would wreck it for you, really, wouldn't it?
It kind of did, to be honest. And so afterwards, I remember when I was touring with my first album and people were saying, Alan Parker, blah, blah. And actually, it's funny, at the time, I was saying, oh, it was so amazing to work with him, blah, blah, blah. But actually inside, I was like, fuck this guy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't a very cool thing to.
No, definitely not.
Especially when the, you know, you're talking to, you know, you're in your 40s and you're saying it to some kid who's in his early 20s. It's not cool.
No, big time. So it kind of leaves it with a bad taste in your mouth. But like after The Commitments, you release so much music.
Yeah.
Like there's singles, albums, EPs. The lot. I actually chronologically went through everything
oh, wow.
This morning, and I think there was only one year that you didn't release anything, and I think it was the year 2000, maybe, up until 2006. You obviously got hit with the millennium bug.
Right.
we had the tinfoil helmet on, we're like waiting for the meltdown to happen on the takeover. But it felt like a really purple patch for you writing music. And to be honest, like, you're always writing music from...
Yeah, one is always writing music. When one releases music or anything like that, it's kind of just down, it's kind of arbitrary, really.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm in an interesting spot now where I just made this record and went in and I met with a bunch of great musicians and just let everything flow. And I did exactly the opposite of what I might have done in the early frames. I didn't say yes or no to anything. I just allowed all the music to come, and then I compiled what I liked at the end. So there is a kind of a certain letting go that one reaches. I certainly, it took me a long time to get there, where you trust the people around you and you just let you allow the sound of what is. And so, yeah, there were long periods where I didn't write either also. And so it's good to know that there are records out there. And who knows what pattern we leave behind. You know, every time you make a record, you're just making a record. And somehow in the middle of all that, there is an arc.
Yeah,
the arc of your career, and who gets to decide what that is?
It's not you.
No, certainly
it's the,
not.
It's the fans and everybody who sort of talks and hypothesizes about it. It's kind of strange that. Well, like, how do you feel about the record? It's like, as we record this in February, it'll be coming out in April. It's called the Wild Willing.
Yeah, this Wild Willing. It's a record that I'm very, very, very happy with. I went to Paris and I got a writer's, I got a kind of a, I was, you know, granted a month in a small room in the middle of Paris to write, and I took it. I'd never done anything like that, like an artist's grant, if you like her. So I went and I wrote between 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. every morning, and then I went for a walk and took my lunch and then tried to get back between 3 and 5. Didn't always succeed in that. But I really treated the time as a kind of a time of discipline. I decided I was going to really try to write some lyrics and write some songs, or maybe even write some stories. And each day, just the act of writing anything, even if it was just thoughts, even if it was just diary entry, really opened me up. And I found myself in a place where these ideas and these songs were coming, and I was able to form them and really interrogate the lyric and really look at what it was. And I was meeting with musicians. I met these Iranian brothers, Koshrevesh brothers, Mani, Nima and Puya. And I asked them to come to the studio. And then I Dunk Murphy, who operates as Sunken Foal, who's an amazing electronic artist in Ireland. Him and my friend DC, who are hip hop guys and are kind of more experimental dance.
Yeah.
I asked them to come in. And that clash of the Persian melodic line with, you know, I spoke to Dave and Duncan and said, what I would really love you to do is come in and really disrupt my music. I'd love you to come in and just drive through the middle of it and see what we get. And I feel like the results were quite successful in that it's, you know, it's still folk music. It's, in a way, it's still pop music, if you like. It's real simple. It's simple songs, but there's elements to them that I think are hanging together in a very interesting way. And I'm very happy with what the result was.
And you talk about like working with Iranian musicians. Like, is world music, I hate that word,
sure,
but it conjures an awful
image.
It's an awful word, but it's just very simplistic and very the point. But like, do you look at other cultures for influence? It sounds like you've kind of got the Irish influence on lockdown.
Well, the Irish influence actually, in a way, opens you up to every other influence, because the Irish influence, if you think about Irish traditional music and you listen to the melodic line, I mean, it's North African. You know, the Bowron, the melodic, the melodies. Mm. And in a funny kind of a way, that Arabic influence has always been there in traditional Irish and English music. And so it doesn't seem like a huge stretch that a Persian instrument might come in, and there's a lot of familiarity there. A few notes that don't necessarily seem to work in the same way, but Jesus, it's
I quite like that sometimes. Powerful. So when you hear like a real sort of dissonant note coming in, you're like going, because you're just waiting for the resolve so you can breathe out again.
100%.
Um, So yeah, we're recording this in London. We're recording this in the basement in a studio in Soho. Now, one thing that sort of Soho is very famous for, well, like Oxford Circus is very famous for, really, is Hare Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, like, when I came here to London 7 years ago, almost 7 years ago, I remember coming out to do my first show at Radio 1. I came out at Oxford Circus and I was greeted by about 20 people dressed in orange, like playing drums and percussion. And I don't think I'd only been to London with I think my dad once before and my mate once before, and we got pissed and went to see Blur. And I was like, is this what London's like all the time? This is crazy.
What year was that?
That would have been in 2011.
Okay, wow. You know, I joined the Hare Krishnas when I was a kid, so I know I was probably in that gang at some point.
What age?
I've done the kirtan. That's what that is. You know, when people go out in the street and they do that thing, it's called the kirtan. I would have been, maybe 17, 18, around that age. I joined just for a little bit.
Yeah.
I went in, I was like, you know what, this is amazing. And I remember my friend Mick Christopher, who's another musician, he was also a Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
And he was working in the Soho, in the, you know, in what's it called, Govindas, here in the Soho. And I remember coming into him a lot and visiting London. And I went to stay at the George Harrison Mansion. And there was a great, very charismatic Krishna kind of devotee, one of the original devotees called Prabhupada, not Prabhupada, Tribhuvanath, who would have been one of the students of Prabhupada.
Mm-hmm.
Who was so it's funny, for me, London is very much about the Krishnas also. Yeah. It's interesting that you say that. But yeah, I went in, I had a look, it was wonderful. I enjoyed it, and then it wasn't for me anymore.
Yeah. You came in, tried it.
Yeah.
But does it leave a lasting impact? What is, like, if somebody is listening to this and they've never heard of it before, like, how do you sum it up to somebody?
The Krishnas?
Yeah.
Well, I think when we're young, we're all looking to connect with something. We're all looking to connect with something bigger than ourselves, maybe, you know, and sometimes that's the arts. And for me, it was the arts.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think there's a kind of a spiritual, for me, there was a spiritual lacking, if you like. And I definitely wasn't finding it in Christianity and in Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of attracted to, you know, because when I was a street musician, the Krishnas used to leave their books beside me, and I'd mind the books. And then sometimes they'd leave the galubjamans, and they used to give these desserts out. And so they would end up feeding us. And then sometimes we'd end up going back down. That's kind of how I got into it.
You got bribed into it.
Well, they've got
food.
I got food. But that's really it. That's, to be honest, I mean, any religion that sort of eats, dances and sings its way to God, it sort of seems like a pretty good one to me.
Yeah.
But then, of course, you know, you go with, when I went in, I definitely felt the restriction, and I felt that it was a very ordered. And a part of me really wanted the order, because there was very little order in my day to day.
Yeah, of course.
And so I really enjoyed the whole, you know, getting up at 5 a.m. and praying, and, you know, but it didn't last long. It wasn't for me.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, if you kind of kept on down the sort of the Catholicism route, mm-hmm. you probably would have ended up a Benedictine monk doing the same sort of, well, it seems a little bit less crack, but the same sort of order.
Yeah. And you know,
wouldn't be good for your music career, having to take a vow of silence. So.
Absolutely. And 100, you know, and at the risk of sounding controversial, I always related more to Protestantism anyway. I was always much more on that. You know, I kind of agree with that aspect, you know.
Aye.
Why not question it? Why not get in and figure out what it's all about? You know, so in a way, what I love
that
about,
must have been a popular view around your house.
You wouldn't have said that too much about that. but I always just kind of, you know, but my name is Hansard, you know, and Hansard is a Huguenot name. And the Huguenots went to Northern England, and they were living, from what I know, they were living on the borderlands. And then Sir Richard Hansard was granted the lands of Lifford.
Uh-huh.
So I think my family are directly related from the north, you know, from Lifford, which originally would have been English. So it's, well, you know, we're all, it's just a huge melting pot, and it always has been.
If I go through your IMDb,
mm-hmm.
It looks like you're the most selective actor of all time. And it looks like you're one of the luckiest too, because you've landed on two projects that feel seminal from when they were made. Like, The Commitments is a seminal 1990s music movie.
Yeah.
And Once is, and I'm not using the word lightly, like, a seminal sort of mid-2000s music movie.
Well, thank you.
And that, I think, what, from that distance, from 1990 to 2006, what's that, 16 years?
Uh-huh.
And then 16 years on, that would be, God, now, wouldn't it? Right?
It would be around now,
So you're due, Yeah. You're due another seminal movie, another seminal music movie.
I have been offered parts in films, and both of those films I fell into by accident, and I'm very happy. And I don't think the films were great due to my acting, so I don't take any sense of responsibility on that. But I'm very fortunate in that I was involved in two films that did have a bit of a life, you know, that they lived on a bit.
Is there anything that you've turned down, and most people have been like, Jesus, Glenn, why the flip did you turn that down?
There was one that I turned down that in a way I'd love to have done it, but then when I saw the film I wasn't so impressed, and it was the role of Rorschach in X-Men.
What?
Yeah, I was offered that role.
You were going to be in a Marvel?
I know. Yeah. I was almost. And just because I fit the bill. And it's the same with the commitments. You know, the reason I got that role was because, someone approached me and said, you've got red hair, you're from the North Side, you play guitar. We're looking for someone who looks just like you. Have you ever acted? No. Do you want to do an audition? Why not? You know, so in a way, it came to me in a way that was very, very easy. And I'm very happy for it. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I don't want to sound disingenuous, but I really loved it. But it was the same at once, you know. Cillian Murphy was to play the guy, and he was playing the guy, and I was delighted because I love Cillian. And then Cillian, I think, did Sunshine at the same time, mm-hmm. and so he couldn't do Once. And so John, in a desperate sort of bid to get the film made, said, you should do it.
Well, you were writing the songs for it.
I was writing the songs, and yeah. I was over the moon about that because it was a great gig for me to get.
It's crazy how these things work out.
Isn't it?
On a very, very much smaller scale, there was a movie shot about punk music in Northern Ireland called Good Vibrations.
Mm.
And I got cast in that as one of the bass players in the band.
Oh, wonderful.
So they wouldn't like, you know.
Terry.
Terry Hooley, the story of Terry Hooley and punk music in Northern Ireland and the Troubles. And I was the bass player in Rudy. And they only sort of cast me because I was a lot thinner at that stage and lanky and could hold the bass and could play it.
You're still thin.
Yeah. but actually, it's funny you should say that because we were all in the Dole at the time, so we were getting 45 quid a week.
Right.
And
I remember it well.
Yeah. And none of us really sort of like knew what it was like to have sort of nice food. So like all the time, unless you went home to your ma's.
Aye.
But when we were all on the set, there was a lovely catering, cheese boards, desserts, the whole thing. That you can notice in the film, if you're keen enough eye, that everybody puts on weight in certain scenes. Where, like, I think everybody was a stone and a half.
Right. You're right.
Yeah, because we were like, fuck, I don't know when this food's going to stop. So it's just like, you know, pack it up and save it for winter.
I remember it with the commitments. There was donuts and cheese and you'd be constantly available. And I remember just eating constantly on that film. Because there's so many hours where you're doing nothing and you're just waiting
around. It's actually really boring. The whole idea of it was amazing.
Yeah.
And like doing it when you did your 130 minutes.
Yeah.
And 12, 14 hours of waiting about.
Sure.
Totally. it broke down the fourth wall for me a little bit too much. We've got a shared love in a band called The Lost Brothers.
Ah, lovely.
They're from my parts of the world. Mark is from OMA, and I know that they have supported you quite a lot, and you've supported them quite a lot.
That's
as well.
Right.
And I almost wanted to sort of use this moment for anybody who's listening to the podcast to go and listen to their music, because they're building a really good audience in Ireland at the moment, and they're they're building a decent audience in America as well. But I feel like their music is such good soul food; it needs to be in every household.
They're deep men, I've had this fantasy. I'd love to make a video with them. Because for me, they kind of, there's echoes of like the Leuven brothers in what they do. And, you know, I would love to make a video for them in Ace Cafe here in London, you know, the biker cafe with those two boys playing and all the bikers sitting. I just have this, I'd love to make that video. So if any video directors are out there, listen to the Lost Brothers and go make that video for them, because I probably don't have time to do it. But their music has this really haunting, deep sort of 50s feel. But then again, it's very modern. Maybe you'll play them maybe you'll play them now. But they're a wonderful, wonderful band. Yeah. And the way they sing together is really compelling. And their writing is really compelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely amazing band. So what does the rest of 2019 hold then? Are you going to get out on the road with this record? Are you going to tear the balls off it, as they say?
Yeah, I am. I'm going to, it takes me right through. I go back to the States, do a little bit there. The tough thing about the touring this year for me so far is I've never been so aware of visa issues than I am now.
Oh, no, with Donald Trump and with
Trump,
Brexit,
of course, and the Italians. And, you know, I'm trying to get the Iranian musicians that I played with, I'm trying to get them on the road with me. And man, it's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, Ireland, it's really hard to get them into Ireland. It took 2 years to get a visa for me to get them into Ireland. And I got them in to play a gig at Christmas. And the audience loved it and they loved it. They had a great time. But now, in order to get them back in for April, it's just nigh on impossible.
You don't think that you have the exact same problem with Ireland? But like, I mean, without going deep into the story or naming names, like I've seen a friend of mine whose missus is from like the other part of the world.
Yeah,
and I'll not go into the story because it's too deep. But it's really fucking difficult.
Yeah. No, exactly. We're moving into a world that seems to be really closing its doors rather than sort of compassion and empathy kind of growing. It seems to be closing down, and it's a strange time we're in, but it's a time that's really important for us all to speak out, not to speak up and speak against, but to speak about who we are. It's not about going against anybody. It's very interesting to see that there are certain countries I can bring my band and there are certain countries I can't.
It's crazy. Like, you were sort of touching on the protest song. Who are your favourite protest singers?
Oh gosh, well, Woody Guthrie would be number one, of course.
What does it say inside of his guitar? This machine kills fascists.
Kills fascists.
Love that.
Yeah, he's a wonderful man. But I find that the great protest singers are just people who sing about humanity. Mm-hmm. Because in fact, you know, the more you sing about the condition of living in the day to day, the more you speak to it politically. Also,
I've been thinking about this quite a lot, like with just punk music and music in general. And I find that it's when the music or the lyrics touch upon not the overarching topic, but the smaller little bit in between it.
Yeah.
So, like, say it wouldn't be poverty. Like, mm-hmm. you know, somebody started writing a song about how fucked up everything is and you know, how little you get money you get from the government and benefits and all the rest. But it's actually like the sort of Ken Loach approach when you've got the heart of somebody and you can see it there instead of going, isn't everything shit?
Yeah.
I always think that for songwriters, they should delve deeper into the character
and why
it means that instead of going, well, everything's fucked.
Yeah, and someone like Ken Loach gets to still make the films he makes because he's had a long, long history of making that film.
Mm-hmm.
He's made that film a lot, and it's a wonderful, wonderful film. And the likes of him and Mike Lee, I'm you know, be a huge fan. I just took a picture actually of the Lida, the stores, the storefront of Lida, where it's the scene in Naked where Maggie, you know, where Johnny meets. I can't remember the guy's name in the film, but I agree with you that nowadays, when you try to sing a political song, it's just shot down by everybody. Like, come on. Like emotional porn, you know. It's just like, stop trying to connect with the people. You know, we're living in an age where we're living in an age where sincerity is seen as a weakness.
Yeah.
Where naivety is seen as a weakness. You know, if you listen
everything's very black and white.
Yeah, listen to early rock and roll and listen to the naivety that's in that and listen to the power it had. There's something I really feel like we really need to reconnect with things like naivety. And, you know, I was involved in an action a couple of years ago where we took over an empty office block in Dublin and turned it into a homeless shelter for, you know, a month. That's how short we got out of it. And what really struck me was how cynical everybody was, you know, about the act. And also, and someone like me becomes an easy target in that, because they go, well, look, you're just doing it to, you know, to hire your profile, to sell records. And in a funny kind of way, they have you dead to rights when they say something like that, even though I'm not, that I know I'm not doing it for that reason. But I can see I can totally see where that cynical...
Yeah, that narrative's coming out
that
of.
That narrative comes out of, and I totally, you know, I could accuse someone else of it. But, you know, sometimes, regardless of what people are going to say and regardless of how people are going to react, sometimes it's better to do it and suffer the cynicism
that
comes out of it.
Do you know what I mean? It's not just what you get out of it, it's what the people that you're doing get out of it.
Exactly.
So it doesn't really matter if it comes back on you, does it?
Exactly. And, you know,
I'd say you've got thick enough skin by now, like.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, and I've heard people who would know this world much better than I do, and I've heard them say, you know, honestly, you're fucked if you do, you're fucked if you don't. So you might as well do.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me today. I've really enjoyed it. And we will get you your... that's not the battered old guitar that we were talking about.
No, actually, I borrowed this. This is a borrowed guitar from Gibson. They're very kind to have given it to me. in Paris, they heard about my radio sessions, and I got a phone call, and they said, if you need to borrow a guitar, we'll gladly give you one. So I'm delighted.
Oh, well, happy days. And now you're going to perform for a 2-hour session for us right now. Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you.